accession number 12279, reel 4.
Captain Brown, reel 4.
Right, the other pilot I should have mentioned was who was flying for Hawkers at the time was Roland Beament, who spent much of his time in the operational side and much of his time on the production testing side for Hawkers. And he eventually went to General Electric, of course, where he became quite, well, very well known.
Were there any of those test pilots who stood out in particular?
I think it's like everything else. You see them only in certain aspects of the work. And I really, if I went across the board with the names I've mentioned, I think they were all very much of the same status, the same caliber. They were all very good. They were all men for the right time. And another name that should have gone in there, of course, is Alex Henshaw, who flew for Supermarines but was testing for them up at Manchester. He was on the production testing side up at Manchester all the time. But Alex did a wonderful job in that respect. And they were all, as I say, all of them very good. They were all skilled pilots, all very good aerobatic pilots. No, I wouldn't like to select any particular one.
Did you ever meet the chap who first flew the Spitfire? Was that Mutt Summers?
Mutt Summers, yes, indeed I did. Mutt was at the later stages of his career when I met him. And he was... Now, Mutt didn't really look like the Hollywood image of a test pilot. He was rather large and bulky. But delightful man, and of course he had had a very good run as a test pilot, and he had just started in the Spitfire, as you so rightly say, and then shortly afterwards it was handed on to Geoffrey Quill, who really ran it throughout the entire war. But Mutt was a great character. As chief naval test pilot at Farnborough, of course, my work was almost equally divided between flying general research aircraft and flying naval aircraft. And while we've largely talked about the general side of it, the jet flying, etc., etc., on the naval side, we did two quite unique things. We landed the first operational twin fighter on a jet, or fighter bomber as it really was, namely the Mosquito, the de Havilland Mosquito. Now this was quite an innovation because it was a much bigger aircraft than we'd ever put on a deck before. It was a much faster aircraft than we ever had put on a deck before, and there were many who believed that because of its wooden construction, it wouldn't stand up to the strains of a deck landing. But in March of 1944, we successfully carried out quite a long series of landings up in the Firth of Clyde. And it was such a success that although we didn't use the Mosquito in the Navy as a carrier aircraft, it led to the development of the de Havilland Hornet, which was really, if I could describe it, as a hot rod Mosquito. It was a single-seat Mosquito, very fast, very overpowered, and a wonderful aircraft, and it served the Navy extremely well. Unfortunately, arrived on the scene just too late to get involved in the war, because I made the first deck landing on the Hornet on an aircraft carrier the day that, it was VJ Day. Now, on the other side, we were very, very keen to put a jet aircraft on an aircraft carrier. But so were the Americans, and it developed into a bit of a prestigious race. And we were ahead in the matter of jet development in the United Kingdom at that stage. And it was a question of finding a suitable aircraft. The choice was pretty well limited to three, that namely the very first jet we ever produced, of which there were only two, and one crashed. There was only one survivor at this time. So that really ruled it out. We couldn't afford to lose that aircraft. But then there was another interesting aeroplane called the de Havilland Spider Crab, which eventually became known as the Vampire. And we decided to put a hook on that and land on an aircraft carrier. And we did this in December of 1945 and beat the Americans to it by about 6 months. We eventually also put a hook on the Meteor and carried out the first twin-engined jet landing. So altogether, there were some quite interesting firsts racked up at Farnborough on the naval side. We also carried out a very interesting experiment in landing aircraft on a rubber deck without the undercarriage. And this was called the flexible deck experiment. And it really involved removing the undercarriage with the idea that an undercarriage on a naval aircraft is so heavily stressed that it represents something between 5% and 7% of the all-up weight of the aircraft. So if you remove this, you can make that quite considerable percentage up with extra armament, extra fuel, or whatever. So we carried out this experiment of landing the aircraft onto literally a rubber deck on its tummy. And we did this again with the Vampire. Very successfully, some 200 landings were carried out, and the whole concept was proven as such. The only problem was it was really too radical, because one would have had to have had rubber decks all over the place ashore as well as at sea, because if you ever had a diversion or you wanted to take your aircraft ashore, you had to have this facility. So it was all a little too radical for its time. But these are the sort of ideas that were generated in abundance during the war. There were all sorts of crazy ideas came up during the war. There was even at one stage an idea put forward by Lord Mountbatten that we should have an aircraft carrier made out of ice. Carve an iceberg into an aircraft carrier, and it was seriously looked at. So all these sort of ideas were floating across the horizon.
Which year was it that you had the flexible deck trials?
Which aircraft carrier?
Which year?
Which year? 1947, 48, and 49. Lasted through all these years.